kind of chilly, and especially even, you know, Canada is chilly even sometimes in the summer, like in the mornings and so forth. So that's something that might be interesting. And also someone asked about kachoris. Well, the way we found out about kachoris, we didn't know what a kachori was. You have to remember, this is 1967 and 1968. There are no Indian stores. There are no spice shops. Nobody, probably there might have been in New Jersey, but I wasn't from New Jersey. I was from Texas. So we didn't know any of these things. I remember the wild goose chase we went on just trying to find asafoetida. We were in Boston, and he was describing asafoetida. And the young man who helped me cook went all over Boston trying to find out what asafoetida was. And he came back, and he had found out that he found out that they used to hang it around people's necks to keep bad spirits away or something like that. But nobody knew what asafoetida was. You got to get an idea. Anyway, this is one of the sweetest times. I want to tell this story just to set the mood for the evening. And Srila Prabhupada was in New York, and he was having a massage, which he did. He had massage before his bath every day, because ever since he had his heart attack, massage was considered to be a part of his medicine. That was his Ayurvedic treatment. He would have mustard oil and camphor massage. We would soak the chunks of camphor in the mustard oil, and either my husband, Gorsundar, or whoever happened to be, there were different people over the years who gave him massage, they would massage him with the mustard oil is very heating, and camphor oil, camphor chunks make it cooling. Don't ask me why, this is just his Ayurvedic prescription. And then, of course, sandalwood and our almond oil on the head, mustard oil not on the head or the face. Anyway, so he was sitting and getting his massage, and oftentimes while he was getting his massage, he would be very, very relaxed and very, what's the right word? Musk? What is the right word for, all I can say, like spiritual ecstasy. Just relaxed and very happy, you know. So during this particular massage, he was sitting with his feet out, because one foot was being massaged and one foot is tucked under. And he's rubbing his hands together, and he's talking about Krishna's laddus and kachoris. And because he was in a kind of an ecstasy state, this happens sometimes, he started saying, I simply want to go to Krishna Loka for Krishna's laddus and kachoris. Krishna has such wonderful laddus and kachoris. Mother Yashoda packs such a nice lunch every day. If you make me laddus and kachoris, I will bless you. Well, we didn't know what a laddu or a kachori was. But we immediately said, tell us how to make them. We want to get blessed. So Kartikeya and I, he taught us how to make laddu and kachoris. The laddus are the kind, because there's so many varieties, I just want to clarify, they're the kind sort of like you get at the Tirupati temple, where you fry the little chickpea flour, we call them like Rice Krispies, because that's from our, you know, generation, rice, little teeny tidbits that fall through the, there's a thing that has holes in it. It has, everybody's looking at me like they don't know what I'm talking about. Okay, there's a round spatula with holes that each one is about a quarter of an inch big. And you make a batter, and then you shake these, you shake it over the ghee, and these little Rice Krispie looking tidbits of chickpea flour, and you've made a batter, fall into the ghee, and they become crunchy. They become like little tidbits. And then you take those out, you fry them all, and you set them aside. And then you take them, and then you cook them with almonds and raisins in a sugar syrup, and you stir it becomes very thick, and then you roll it into a ball. And these are, you see pictures of Krishna holding laddu. That's what he's holding. That's considered one type of laddu. Anyway, it was the type that Prabhupada liked. So that's what we're focusing on here. I'm sure there's hundreds of different types of laddus. And so the Prabhupada used to say that sometimes people would travel on trains and they'll take one or two of these big laddus, like the size of a softball, and that they'll live on for days. And by the way, I later did that whenever I used to travel in India. I'd go to the Tirupati temple, I'd buy some of those softball-sized laddus, and you can literally live on them for days because the chickpea flour is a protein, you know, it's a full nutrition. Anyway, so he taught us how to make the laddus, and then he taught us how to make the kachoris. There are many kinds of kachoris. The kind of kachori that he specifically liked, and this is real important because everybody's always asking me this, it's just like a puri. It looks exactly like a puri, only it's lined on the inside with ur dal. So it's very difficult to make. I could never make it now. I think it was a special empowerment that I was able to make it at that time. But what you do is you have to make an ur dal paste, almost like toothpaste. You soak the ur dal overnight. You blend it with a really good blender so that there are no chunks. The reason you don't want any chunks is because you have to roll it out while it's inside. And the little peas, if there's any chunks of peas, they'll poke through and make a hole. And then it won't puff up. So you have this toothpaste looking ur dal, and you have a rather not too hard puri dough, which means it has ghee in the dough. Knead it really good, and then you put the you put a little bit of asafoetida and a little bit of salt, and that's the only spices he had in it. Inside this little cuppy, a cupped up thing of the dough, and then you roll it out. And it's very difficult because it has a tendency to squish out one little place or squish out another place, and then it's no good. Then it won't puff up. And then you put it into the ghee, not too hot. You put it into the ghee, and at Prabhupada taught, it puffs up, and then you quickly take it out. And then you let it sit there for a little while, and then you take it and put it again in the ghee, and he said, it will turn reddish. It turns reddish. Those were his words. So this is how, so what the end result looks like, it looks like a slightly reddish golden puri that's lined on the inside with ur dal. So I want to clarify this for all posterity that this is what he's referring to when he said kachoris, and kachoris were his favorite food. And when you eat these kachoris, you almost think, boy, I feel like this is food for the gods or something. You know, it's so unique. And he liked to have it. Somebody needs help at the door. There's a lady with crutches. She needs some help. Believe me, I have no idea how I was able to make those. I could probably never do it again. I must have been empowered, temporarily empowered by Krishna or by Lakshmi to do it. So once, whenever he was leaving for Montreal. We were staying in Seattle, and this was kind of a tense time, because he had some problem with his visa. So he had to fly outside the country and re-enter the country. I didn't deal with his visa, so I don't know why this requirement was there. I don't know exactly. Brahmananda would be the one that probably knew that. But my job was my job. So my job was to make his lunch for the airplane and to get him packed for the journey. And we were in Seattle, and the plan was that he would be flying alone to Montreal, because we were very poor in those days. You have to understand, we didn't, and he would be flying alone to Montreal. Gursinder had left for Hawaii, and I would be packing all of the household things, his books and everything, and I would be flying to Los Angeles from Seattle and moving the whole household to Los Angeles, while he went outside the country, Canada, to make a re-entry. And then I would be flying from Los Angeles to Albuquerque and meeting him there. Okay? So this is a... So I was making kachoris for his journey, and they came out good that day. I have to say, they all came out really, really good that day. And so I was rolling them out, puffing them up, and bringing them in. But you see, I was concerned that this is, he was leaving for this plane flight. He had to have enough. And he liked to have them with wet potato vegetable. That's how he ate his kachoris, with a kind of a chopped up potato. You pan fry the potatoes a bit in some spices and a little ghee, and then put water. And so it's called wet. Wet vegetable means it's got a little water in it. Dry vegetable means no water in it. We all know that, right? So that's, so on that day, he kept calling for more kachoris. Bring more, bring more. And at about seven kachoris, I said, he was called Prabhupada by now. Prabhupada, if you eat any more, there's not going to be any for your flight. And he said, never mind, bring more. So he, so I brought more, and I think he had about eight or nine that day. And so he really did like this type of kachori. And I made enough more, and then he got on the flight, and he flew to Montreal. And then I backed up the whole household, moved everything down to Los Angeles. Then I flew to Albuquerque, and I met him. And it was only 2 days. He was gone 2 days. In that whole year, I was separated from him for only those 2 days. And those 2 days seemed so long. They just seemed so long. And then whenever he arrived, we went through a whole drama in Santa Fe and Albuquerque. We'll save that for another day. And that was a good one. Then I flew with him from Albuquerque to Los Angeles. And because Gursinder had left for Hawaii, it was just me and him. And he was sitting, I sat on one side of the, because I didn't want to sit next to him as out of respect. So I sat, it was a small airplane. I sat across, the aisle is here, it's a small bird, so it was a small aisle. And he sat over here and I sat over here. And he showed me his hand. He had fallen down on the steps in the Chicago airport during a change of planes and injured himself. And I was very concerned because he, you know, it hurt him. I mean, at 75 years old, falls are different than 25 years old. And so he told me, he said, from now on, I won't ever travel. I will always travel with someone. I won't ever fly alone from now on. So now I've been talking up a storm about the food. Is there somebody that's come up with some questions in that amount of time? Otherwise, I'll keep talking about prasadam here, making everyone hungry. Let's see. Oh, I should tell you about his puffed rice set. Okay, go ahead.
I had a question about the kachuris. So the kachuris that we make usually on Srila Prabhupada's appearance or disappearance day, are they, usually they make the pea kachoris, so that's not his favorite kind of kachoris?
What kind of kachoris?
Pea and potato kachoris, usually a pea, you know, like a
spoon. Well, that's a different kind of kachori. I don't know. Maybe he liked those too. I'm just telling you what I know, which was, these were what he, when he said, I want to go to Krishna Loka for Krishna's ladus and kachoris, this is, and we said, teach us how to make ladus and kachoris. This is the variety of kachori, and this is the variety of ladu he taught us. I think there's lots of different varieties of ladus.
Is that recipe in Yamuna's cookbook?
So I can see.
Is that recipe in Yamuna's cookbook?
Probably. I don't actually know, but I imagine it would be. There's a lot of different kinds of kachoris. But this was urd dal, whole wheat flour, and I think it was a mix, though. At least a little bit of white. The ladies would probably know. It's a real art to make this kind of kachoris, because when you roll that out, the urd dal paste squishes out. Another thing that he really liked in the evening, usually he would only have a cup of milk with maybe less than a teaspoon of honey. That was the only sweets he ate, just less than a teaspoon of honey in his milk at night. But sometimes he would say, you can give me that puffed rice set. And the puffed rice set, does anybody know what the puffed rice set? I don't know if they've had that in temples or not. It's the most strange combination, but it's absolutely delicious. And what it is you pan fry peanuts separately. Then you take the peanuts out. You pan fry some potatoes, but they're like in long little, skinny little, like little miniature French fries, sort of. And you pan fry those. And then you get a big thing of puffed rice. And usually you like to warm it a little bit because it makes it very crunchy. But not in ghee, just dry. You warm it so it becomes crispy. And then on a plate, his plate, we put a great big mound of this slightly warmed puffed rice. And you put the peanuts and the potatoes in the center of it. And then you peel cucumbers. This is the part that's bizarre. Oh, look, she knows. She's Bengali. No, you're not Bengali, but you're Indian. Anyway, so you peel the cucumbers and you cut them in long slices. And you range the cucumber slices around the edge of the plate. And honestly, it sounds weird. It is the most delicious combination you could ever imagine. And he would eat this in the evening sometimes. Not always, but he would call it that puffed rice set. So, can't hear you, Sri Devi. I'm sorry.
Did you say that he did not eat sugar except for the honey and in the evening?
Well, he actually had diabetes that he controlled with diet. And no, he didn't eat any sugar at all. He ate a tiny bit of honey. And he never criticized a yogi diet. He said a yogi diet's very, very good. But most people can't follow a yogi diet of just fruits and nuts and so forth. A very austere diet. It's actually better. So, he didn't eat any sweets. Later on, I know people would present him with big plates of sweets. This was the customary. This is what we did. I would bring him a giant plate, you know, like so much prasadam on there. And he would eat a few pieces, and then it would be distributed to the devotees. The object of it was, of course, to distribute it to the devotees. Because we all knew the story of Narada Muni by now. We had all found that out. And we knew that, do you know what I'm talking about? That Narada Muni ate the remnants of the prasadam from the Bhaktivedantas. And so, actually, simply by taking the remnants of the prasadam of a great soul, one acquires great sukriti. So that's why we would make this big plate, and then we would distribute most of it. Like he would take one bite out of, there'd be sweets galore, and he would just take one bite out, and all the rest would get distributed. And I had a special affinity for his strips of papaya after he had eaten them. Yeah, maybe that's why I was still with the water, those strips of papaya.
I didn't write this down. Are you still written questions, or is it all right just to ask? Is it all right just to ask a question like this, or do you have to write it down? Do you have to write the questions down, or can we just ask them directly to you?
Well, you either way. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I gave that option of writing questions down because sometimes people have questions and they're afraid they may not be politically correct, or maybe they're shy. And so I thought it was just a nice thing to do. But if you don't feel shy about it, you can ask the question. The problem is my hearing, of course.
Okay. So my question is, I spend a little time with Achyutananda, who lives here, and I've been reading his book, Blazing Sadhus. And in that book, he talks about when Srila Prabhupada was in India and Achyutananda was with him, that there was a situation where he asked for, he wanted a dhoti. And Prabhupada said, don't ask. Did you read his book, Achyutananda's book?
I read his book. I don't remember that particular story.
Well, he kept saying, don't ask. And Achyutananda asked him three times. And the reason Prabhupada said, no, don't ask me about that, is that it's some kind of superstition.
Yeah, yeah. Now I remember, but I don't remember what the superstition was. I do remember.
Yeah, if you ask about it. Achyutananda thought it was a cloth shop, but it was actually a dhobi, a washerman place.
Oh, right. Now I remember that seeing a dhobi was, there's a
Or asking about a dhobi or something before you're doing a certain thing.
A dhobi is a washerman.
So my question is, in your time with Srila Prabhupada, did you see him do different things kind of, like quote-unquote superstitious, motivated type things?
You know, I wonder how much really superstition these things are. Just like in our class recently, we were reading about how Rukmini had Queen Rukmini, as in Bhagavatam, had a twitch in her left side. And so she knew that, something good's going to happen. Krishna's going to come and get me. Well, I think that a lot of these things, we may not understand them, but there's a possibility that they may have some real meaning. And I have an Indian, Sri Gaurangi is nodding over here, so maybe she can answer this question better than me. Oh, please. Oh, okay, but I saw you nodding, so I thought maybe you could give some light on this.
I can't think of an example, but yes, there's a lot of things go back, way back, that we may not understand culturally, and even from the Bhagavatam, ancient scriptures that we may not understand now. At this point in time, it may seem like very different or quoted as superstitious. There's a lot of meaning to certain reasons why things were done.
So the reasons are in antiquity, and they really actually perhaps have had some. They come from some original source. I know I recently had a very, very nice young man help me over at, he was helping me move some furniture, and there were these lizards jumping around on the porch. And he's from South India. And those lizards, they bring bad luck. He assured me that they bring bad luck if they touch you. However, I don't know that we have anything like that in our culture, but my friend Manjari was telling me, she's been living in India, she's a close friend of mine, lives in Vrindavan for many, many years. She was saying that even in the Quran, it says, don't touch a lizard, and in the Vedas, it says, don't touch a lizard, and actually their skins are poisonous, and Manjari was telling me there was a story, a real true story, of a lizard had fallen into a water pot. And they didn't know it was in there, and the people drank the water and died. And so lizards are traditionally considered to be, maybe it's not exactly a superstition, there's a reason for not letting that lizard touch you, because they have a poisonous body.
Thank you. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Can you hear me? You know, Because we were talking about prashadam, this isn't about the lizard. Do you want to see if anybody else has anything to add? Because I appreciated what you said. There's a lot that we don't understand and we take as superstitions. It's important that we...
Yeah, I think what we're calling superstition in the West might not be considered superstition in India. Yeah. It might be that this culture is so old, there have been certain actions and reactions that have been observed. But so far as Prabhupada was concerned, I can't think of any instances like that, but there probably were some. I know one was that... Can you give her the microphone?
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you a question as well, but Shigarangi Bru was saying about Srila Prabhupada being aware of travel times, Ekadasi's Thursday, not traveling on Thursday, or...
Oh, yeah, he did used to say that.
Yeah.
I never took that as a superstition. I took it as an astrological thing. He never would travel on Thursday. He would say, somebody would book a flight on Thursday and would say, do you want to get me killed? And so his Guru Maharaj, whenever he would, he said that when his, I'm sure everybody knows this, his Guru Maharaj, if he had to travel on a Thursday afternoon, he would put his bags outside the door on Wednesday night. Hey, I still do that. I mean, I thought everybody did that. You know, and that's not a superstition. That's just normal, isn't it?
And that's Ekadasi as well, or just the Thursday?
Ekadasi?
Yeah, is Ekadasi, traveling on Ekadasi?
Well, Ekadasi, if you ever notice, things always turn out weird when you try to do stuff. I mean, you don't need to be superstitious. Just try doing something mundane on Ekadasi. After a couple of times, you'll figure it out that it doesn't work. So, yeah, because the idea is the Lord's Day, and you're supposed... I mean, if you're traveling to a temple, that's different from traveling to go make a business deal, which probably isn't going to work because it's Ekadasi. So, yeah, I never think of those things as superstition, really. I mean, astrologically, there's so much information in the Jyotish Shastra. We all know that. And Prabhupada had his Panchika. You know the Panchika? Panchika is the book that he carried with him. And he consulted it every day. And whenever he would give an initiation, it's an astrological. They haven't... anybody Bengali here? Shigarangi, are you Bengali? Well, anyway, it's in Bengali. It's a Panchika is a book of the planets and where they're positioned. And so he would always check the Panchika before traveling, before we would travel to another place, or for initiations, or for different things, because there's certain things that you do and you don't do, right? I mean, that's an astrological common sense,
right? You know what's interesting? I mean, over the years, we always heard Srila Prabhupada, you know, that as devotees, we never have anything to do with astrology. We don't think about astrology. It's not part of our, you know, tradition. And here, now we find out that Srila Prabhupada actually...
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand a lot of...
For many years, we were always told that as devotees, we don't think about astrology.
Well, so I think that's probably true, that Prabhupada discouraged it because people tend to get too much into it. They really tend to go off the deep end, and we've all seen that. But so far as the planetary influences, when Gaurisundar left, Prabhupada sent me a letter and said it's due to some supernatural effect of the stars on him. And that letter is a letter to me. I still have it. So that's proof that, yes, of course he considered the astrological influences, and he carried the Panchika with him, and he consulted it every day whenever we would do something, you know, for travel or for just mundane, you know, not mundane, but activities like, you don't want to do certain things on an eclipse, do you? You want to do certain things on, you know, this is...
Just practical living in the world to bring some ease.
Yeah, practical things. Yeah. And so far as astrology, Patita Pavana was already an astrologer whenever he was initiated by Srila Prabhupada in Santa Fe in 1968. And he was already a practicing astrologer and actually had a discussion with Srila Prabhupada about astrology, which he will share with you if you ask him. I think it's on his newsletter. I mean, I think the general discouragement toward this is because people start to get so much into it and they start to think, ultimately Krishna is in control of all the planetary influences, and ultimately the demigods are all serving him. It's the planetary influences are simply they're his generals or his commanders or his governors, or they're in charge. Like he always says, Indra is in charge of the water system. Prabhupada says that in his books, and so many different devas are in charge of the various aspects of our lives. We think we're moving around freely, but the truth is we're very conditioned souls. Everything that happens to us, when I go outside and I stump my toe, that's like there's a little bit of karma there, you see? And how does the karma working? It's working under the various devas. And so Prabhupada didn't want us to get too much into it, but it can also, rather than being a deviation, so to speak, it can also be utilized like anything. It can be useful. And Srila Prabhupada he always used the Panjika. I don't even know how to spell the word. I just knew that he had this little book called the Panjika, and he would check it every time he'd go, Panjika? Panjika. I think that's a Bengali word, isn't it? Anyway, I don't know how we got off on that. But so, that's what these discussions are for, to bring up things that we all would like to know about.
The question that I had is that in relation to what we offer to the Lord, we're coming into a time in Kali Yuga where so much is becoming more and more contaminated. We're in a time in Kali Yuga where things are very contaminated.
When what was contaminated?
Everything. You know, we're thinking, we are making decisions of what we offer to the deities, right? About food, milk, butter, so many things have chemicals and hormones and so many things, right? Can you understand what I'm saying?
I don't understand what she's saying.
She was asking how to understand so many food products are polluted today due to advent of Kali Yuga, like polluted food products, polluted wheat, polluted milk.
Oh, right.
How do we balance that with what we offer to the deities?
Well, I remember that when I was first in Hawaii, I worked for C. Brewer, and that was a company that processed sugar cane. And I found out in the course of my work that sugar, white sugar, is processed through charcoal, which comes from bones, animal bones, cow's bones. So I brought up this point to Srila Prabhupada. And his mood was, what can be done? This is the age of Kali. Everything is contaminated. Everything is impure. We do the best we can to get whatever we can offer. We offer what is there. Now, I know a lot of people don't have this idea, and I think it's better, the best things you can possibly offer to Krishna, you should offer. But remember, Krishna can turn anything to nectar and even poison with it in the case of Mirabai. But then on the other hand, should we offer Krishna poison? So, I mean, she was forced to offer Krishna poison by her elders, but we're not. So, I don't really know if it's possible. I think it's better to get the best quality of items to offer the Lord. But if a person is absolutely strapped for cash and has no other way, it's better to offer something, because really, it's the love that counts. Remember the story about offering the banana peels to Krishna by, what was her name? The wife of Vidura. And so ultimately, it's the mood of offering. But if our mood of offering is that, well, you know, this is, I could do better. I can, if I have my choice between organic pears and conventional pears, I'm going to choose the organic pears because they're a nicer offering and they're healthier. So that's what I'm going to do. I think it's an individual thing. I don't know that temples can always afford to do this. And there were some people who were very opposed to sugar back in the 70s. I mean, it was a big deal at that time because, oh, sugar's bad for you. Now people kind of know that a lot of sugar is not good for you, but at that time, people didn't know, and whenever it actually, they realized that it became a huge thing. And there was a particular devotee who was really opposed to sugar. Prabhupada was too much. He came to visit Prabhupada along with some other devotees. And Prabhupada ordered puris. He asked for puris and a bowl of sugar. And he sat there and doused the puri in sugar and ate it. And then he offered this devotee some puris doused in sugar. And the devotee refused. Now, if I'd been in that place, I would have said, gimme. I'll eat all the sugar I can get from you. But, you know, this, in a way, that is kind of like putting your own ideas and being attached to your own ideas. So we don't want to go that far. At the same time, we want to try to eat what's healthy. Because a lot of devotees do get problems from, health problems. We all know that. But we can't eat like we could back when we were in our 20s. I was able to eat. We used to make oatmeal halva. You haven't lived until you've had oatmeal halva. It's so good. I used to eat like a plate of it and then save a plate for the next morning, too. So we were able to do that. We were in our 20s, but we're not able to do that anymore. So we have to be more reasonable. And it is true. And I've heard this is true of other saints as well. Prabhupada tried to encourage us, eat more, eat more, eat more prasadam. He actually practically stuffed us, is the truth. He really did. And I've heard Neem Karoli Baba did this also. I've heard this is a practice that's common in India. And the concept is that the conditioned soul is starving for spiritual life. And they've been starving for centuries. And so the prasadam, in this age of Kali, prasadam is a special gift in the age of Kali, that prasadam has power of spirituality in it. It's actually embedded with spiritual energy. And that prasadam, if given to that soul, can actually elevate him. That's why Prabhupada is so adamant. Who was it? Was giving a class the other day and said something about someone came to the temple and they left without prasadam. And he said, Prabhupada said, so what is the use? In other words, you blew it. Why didn't you give him prasadam? So it's important because I have read, and I'm not a scholar on this, I'd be very interested to have more information, that in the previous yugas, this dispensation of prasadam was not available. I don't know at exactly which point it started. I should ask some of my scholar friends about this. Do you know something about this?
It started with Shrimati Parvati Devi.
I know the Devi had something to do with it. Wasn't
she did. She asked, because Lord Shiva didn't save her, the Mahaprasad that he had gotten from Narada Muni, who had received it from Lakshmi. I mean, he had done austerities, to receive this Maha Prasad.
Uh-huh.
And so he was dancing all over the universe with his Veena, and Lord Shiva saw him and asked how it is that he was dancing in such ecstasy. And he said how he had received this Prasad, which is very rare. And Lord Shiva said, of course, you've saved some for me. And of course he didn't. And he found a little bit under his fingernail. And then he also began to dance in ecstasy, and almost just like a dance that was so energetic that Srimati Parvati Devi had to stop him, and she inquired, well, how is it you're in such ecstasy? And when he told her, she said, well, of course you saved some for me, and by then, of course, there was none. So the Lord himself had to come and mediate, because he said something that wasn't very helpful in that moment, something about, well, she's just, you're not qualified, something like that, something inferring that. So the Lord came to mediate that situation. And she was willing to perform austerities, and she asked a benediction that everyone should receive this prasadam. Women, children, everyone, qualified or unqualified, should receive this. So it's by her mercy that we have this whole scale distribution prasadam. That's my understanding, but there may be other stories.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for that enlightening.
Lord Chaitanya also preached about the glories of prasadam. Lord Chaitanya?
Yes. Well, but what I mean is, I didn't know. Was it, what age did it just start in the Kali Yuga? That's what I don't know. Is it something that was present in the previous Yuga too? Or did it start? But in any case, Prabhupada stressed it hugely, and he would, that's one reason he taught us how to cook, and he himself cooked. And in the very beginning, he did all the cooking in New York, and he would just come around to our plates and put more chapatis on, and more chapatis, and take more, and take more. And this is still, you know, this is, so people, even if they can't, they're so fallen in the age of Kali, if we give them prasadam, it's a start. They will at least get human birth. Because Prabhupada used to say, most people nowadays, especially Americans, most of them will take birth as cats or dogs. And then from cats and dogs, it's usually downhill from there. So it's important to share this, and that's why it's so nice. You see so many prasadam programs going on all over, and it's having an effect. It's cumulative. So there's something in here. This is all about food today. Oh, he asked to have lady fingers one day. Well, we didn't know what lady fingers were. And lady fingers are actually okra. And the British name for okra is lady fingers. And people in the north have never even heard of okra. My being from the south, I knew what okra was, but I didn't ever know it was called lady fingers. And so he is sitting there describing it, you know. It's green and it's point string beans. And it's, no, not string beans, it's pointed. And so after some time, we figured out okra. And then we got some and we showed it to him. And then he had us cook the okra. He liked to have the okra cooked with potato in a dry vegetable. And he would often have that. He really liked it. They call it bindi. In India, its name is bindi. We all know that now. But we didn't know any of that then. And generally, what he had every day was chapatis, rice, three sabjis, and dal. And four chapatis, usually. And he liked to have them, or he would bring them in just as he's finishing the last bite of one. You come in with another one that's puffed up. And, of course, your life revolves around whether or not the chapati puffs up each day, sort of. I mean, that's how you feel, anyway. And usually it was three sabjis, cauliflower and potato and string beans would be a wet vegetable. Eggplant, tomato and spinach would be a dry vegetable. Or maybe okra and potato. And some rice and some dal and some chapatis. And generally he would eat once, you know, at noon or a little after noon. And And then after that, he would take rest for a couple of hours. So that's my discourse on food. Are there any other questions of how Prabhupada ate?
You have a couple questions there?
Oh, duh. Thanks. What is Srila Prabhupada's favorite vegetable? What is his favorite fruit? And does he like mustard oil with his puffed rice? Well, I never saw him eat mustard oil. I've heard that later on, when he was in India, his sister would cook with mustard oil, but that it was not good for his digestion. But myself, I never was aware of any mustard oil except for his massage. And he did often say that oil is for the outside of the body and ghee is for the inside of the body. And oil is for offering to Lord Shiva and ghee is for offering to Lord Krishna. So this was the common understanding that we had in those days. So we never used anything. We never used oil for any cooking at all. I think it's become very common now, especially in the Gujarati temples, because Gujarati people, generally speaking, prefer oil to ghee. I've actually had them tell me so. They like oil better. They like the taste better. But generally speaking, that's what Prabhupada had. He always used ghee. And so far as his favorite fruit, I would say mango. He loved mangoes. And he used to say, I will come to Hawaii and I will simply live on mangoes and milk. And then, of course, there's that famous letter where he said, Govindadasi has tricked me. She said it was mango season and I get here and it's rat season. You know, everybody's heard about that letter, I'm sure. You know. But actually, the mangoes hadn't come in yet and the rats had, so... We had a lot of rats in Hawaii. And his favorite vegetable? You know, I would tend to say loki. Loki, that green squash? He really liked loki. But, you know, he liked all vegetables, but he did seem to like loki a lot. And he would have me cook the loki in milk. And loki you cook in milk and it becomes like a pudding. But I would say definitely mangoes. He really liked mangoes. He liked papayas also. He liked all these tropical fruits. And I had never even seen a papaya or a mango. In those days, there wasn't a huge Indian population in Houston. And I grew up near Houston. And so mangoes and papayas, maybe people ate them, but I didn't know anybody that ate them. And they're just, it was a different time. Now, if you go to any store, you'll find mangoes and papayas. I think Prabhupada instituted it myself. I think it's just waves of the big boat. So let's see what this other question is here. Did Srila Prabhupada change his overall demeanor, or does this person mean vision, from 1967 to 1977, from small group to worldwide movement? Well, I don't know if demeanor, I think his overall vision was always, I know his overall vision was always a worldwide movement. That I'm sure of. I would say demeanor, he definitely, when it was small, there was definitely a more hometown feeling, a more of a family feeling, that's true. So the way, whenever he had to deal with hundreds and hundreds of disciples, and he had to deal with so many problems later on, he definitely had to deal in a little different way. He didn't have any problems. There were, in the beginning, whenever I was with him from January of 1967 to the time we went to Hawaii in January of 69, as of that time, there weren't really any politics. There weren't any sannyasis. There weren't any leaders. He was the leader. He ran the show. And anybody that decided they wanted to be running the show a different way just didn't succeed in doing it, because he would shut it down. I mean, there were a lot of things that happened. I mean, there was one particular brahmachari who later was a sannyasi. He wanted to ship all the women to Australia. I was just having a meeting with Vishaka today. We were talking about those issues. And Prabhupada just kept blocking them. You know, they would have all these strange attitudes just because they were young and they were having a hard time being brahmacharis. And so they wanted to get rid of all the ladies. And Prabhupada told them to go to the forest if you have that agitated. So there was those things were going on, but he was always there to clean up the mess and change things and block, you know, different types of directions that were going to in any way threaten his movement. And of course everyone knows about the huge event that took place in New Vrindavan in 1971, I think it was, where he was very distressed. It was the only time he actually said, I was for the first time in my entire life, the last few days, I have not been properly able to serve my Guru Maharaj. And it was due to the agitation of the several young men who had a political agenda. And everyone knows about this. It's pretty common knowledge. It took place in New Vrindavan, and there were some meetings. I didn't know anything about it at the time because we were in Hawaii, and so we weren't really a party to it, but it's pretty common knowledge. And then I believe he gave those young men sannyas to get them out of the society so that they would have to travel and go do something else and not be in charge of situations. Because the idea of sannyas was, of course, to travel from place to place, not spend more than a few days in each place. But whenever in the very early 2 years, there was none of that. That started in about 1971 or 72, the politics. And he had to constantly field things, you know, he had to... you know, anytime you have a great big movement, you have so many diverse types of people, and then they're going to get the idea, well, it should be like this. And somebody else is going to get the idea, well, this movement should be like this. And somebody else is going to think it should be like that. But what happens is, it's his movement. Let him run it the way he wants to. Don't try to step in and run it the way you think it should be run. And when Prabhupada was here, he was able to block those different events, which are all historical. They all took place. And so naturally his demeanor was different. He had to be heavier. He had to be much heavier. You know, some people think that Prabhupada was really harsh and sauce and all this stuff, and I never experienced that. That just wasn't a part of our world in the early days. The only thing I ever got the sauce for was burning the peanuts. So, I mean, you know, it was a simple time. And I remember somebody asking him, were those times special, those early times in New York, early times in San Francisco? Oh, yes, they were very special. Because if you think about it, people are attracted for different reasons. And in those days, there was only Srila Prabhupada in a dumpy little apartment in Lower East Side with a dumpy little temple with absolutely no money and absolutely no cars and no this and no that and no positions. So the people that came at that time were attracted to him. They were attracted to his purity. And then, of course, I'm not saying it was always that way, but a lot of the things that happened later, because anytime you have a religious organization, you're going to have, you know, people are going to come to Krishna consciousness for different reasons. There's, you know, basically four kinds of people who come, and some people will be attracted because of position or power or money or fame or whatever it is. But in the very early times, there wasn't any of that, so the mood was softer. I would say, to answer this question, his demeanor was softer in those days and more gentle because he didn't have to be heavy. He had to be heavy later on, but his vision was always that of a worldwide movement. It's just that how soon it was going to happen. And one of the most beautiful times, we were with him in Bhubaneswar in 1977, and he was sitting outside. He always loved, more than anything, more than big temples, he loved his cow dung huts. You know, these cow dung huts, they're very cool. They're like thick mud cow dung, and they're thatched on top. And he loved to stay. He had one in Mayapur, and he had one in Bhubaneswar, and he loved to stay in those. And they have a dirt floor, cow dung floor, you know. And he was sitting outside that hut, and it was just in the very beginning of the Bhubaneswar. Bhubaneswar is near Puri. It's in Orissa. And they had some land, and there's a farm there. And Prabhupada was sitting outside, and he was saying, now the land has been tilled, because they had tilled the land. The furrows were there. And the seeds have been planted. And it was an allegorical thing. He was talking about the field, but he was talking about much more than the field. He was talking about his movement. Because he said, so now the seeds have been planted and the plants are coming up. There are some plants coming up and they will become big bushes after some time. And then, in due course of time, they will become big trees. And then, after some time, then they will grow fruits. And then he said, and then, then you shall see what is this movement of Lord Chaitanya. So we ain't there yet, but it's definitely going to happen because Lord Chaitanya predicted it, and it will be very glorious. People shouldn't be discouraged at little bumps in the road, and this problem or that problem that this movement has. It's spreading at a phenomenal rate because prasadam is going out and chanting is happening and sankirtan is happening. Sankirtan meaning chanting of the holy name, congregational chanting of the holy name. That's the meaning of the word sankirtan. Glory to the Sri Krishna sankirtan, which cleanses the heart of dust accumulated for lifetimes after lifetime. We all know the Shikshastak. Everybody knows the Shikshastak by heart. But what does it mean? Sankirtan, Lord Chaitanya is saying, this is the Yuga Dharma. This is actually the sacrifice that's prescribed in Kali Yuga. And that is Sankirtan, group chanting of the holy name. Sankirtan, that word, does not mean it. Other things. It means group chanting of the holy name. I just was seeing in the books the other day, chanting in assembly, chanting the holy names of the Lord in assembly. And you know, we get busy. I mean, I could say in my life as well, I have my iPods and I have my CD players and I listen, and when I'm driving I listen. But what Krishna wants is the sacrifice of your breath. He wants, the sacrifice is singing the holy names in the assembly of devotees. Singing Hare Krishna. That's the actual meaning of Sankirtan. That's the actual meaning of the Yuga Dharma, which is prescribed. In other words, we had different processes prescribed in the Vedas for various yugas. The yoga process was in the Satya Yuga. People could sit for hundreds of years in meditation. Now you can sit for 15 minutes in meditation, or if you're lucky, maybe a couple of hours. You can't really get a perfection with that very well. And then you had your temple worship, and then you had your fire sacrifices, but people can't perform these things anymore. There's no Brahmins who can who can actually say these mantras so perfectly that an animal can walk into the fire and walk out as a new young animal. The animal's not going to be able to do that. I mean, people have become lost in the age of Kali. And philosophies of various sorts abound, all kinds of Western philosophies, from existentialism to all these very philosophies of darkness, is what you might say. And now, of course, technology has its good sides because we're able to spread the movement more quickly. But what it really boils down to, each age is given a gift, a form of sacrifice that they will be capable of performing so that they can go back to Godhead or get liberation or whatever it is that they are trying to do to get out of the samsara, to get out of the suffering. Basically, that's what people want to do, get out of the suffering. And so in this age of Kali, the Sankirtan is the actual Yuga Dharma. That means the prescription. Doctor says, here's the prescription, is group chanting of the holy name. And you're so fortunate here because you have kirtan every day. And I personally am very kirtan deprived because of my life in the last few years taking care of my mother. I've got plenty of iPods, I've got plenty of CD players, but there's a difference. There's definitely a difference with just hearing and actually chanting an assembly. So I'm looking forward to the Festival of the Holy Name coming up this week. It's going to be really wonderful. And you're really fortunate in this community to have this. Other places don't have this, you know. It's worth it to tolerate the weather. Is there any more questions? Are you getting tired? I think you're stretching, and some people are yawning. And
I think, did you read the second question?
I did. I got both questions answered. They're both of them. Is there any more?
In terms of astrology, I've heard Srila Prabhupada say that it's good to use it as an umbrella. In terms of Vedic astrology, heard Srila Prabhupada that he has said that it's good to use it as an umbrella.
What do you mean?
You know, to know what's going on with the planets.
Yeah, it's sort of like a weather report. That's right. How I use it. I check the weather report every day, see what kind of transits I have. Just to, you know. But that's a good point, as an umbrella. I had never thought of that. Prabhupada said that?
Yes, I mean, that's what I had heard.
So, I never heard him say that, but yeah, it's just to help you. It's just a tool, but sometimes people get really caught up in it, and they lose sight of the overview, but it can be very helpful. Astrology can be very helpful, and there's some very good astrologers in this movement. Patita Pavana does a newsletter every month. A free newsletter, you get it online. I just sent you one. And it's always about, there are things about Srila Prabhupada, things about the movement, all kinds of interesting things. Like there was this one issue was very interesting, where there was the first person who saw Prabhupada come into the Boston Harbor. This was a young man who was on a Navy ship. I forget his name. He's an initiated devotee. And as Prabhupada's, the Jaladuta was plying into the Boston Harbor, Prabhupada was standing on the railing, on the deck, and this young man was standing on the deck of a Navy boat. And as they passed, it was like that instant exchange, and he later became a devotee. And things like that. I mean, those are. And he described. There was an article in there where he described his experience, what he felt, and what's so amazing is like this is the. I mean, Prabhupada's just coming into America, and there's a boat passing, and already he's making a devotee. I thought that was really cool.
I'm not sure how to ask this question, Michael, but after having such close association with Srila Prabhupada, how do you survive after that?
How do you survive?
Yeah, how do you survive without him? Without that?
It's like having dessert first, and then you gotta eat the rest of it. So it's like, I think about that sometimes. Yeah, it's like having the best part of your life first. But then on the other hand, you have to remember, he's still here, watching over us. And if you tap into the spiritual, he said, I'm present in my pictures. He said, if you chant Hare Krishna, I'll be with you. If you meditate on Srila Prabhupada, you can feel his presence. It's much harder. I acknowledge that it's much harder. It's much, much harder because most of the time, the world grabs us and pulls us this way. Oh, you got to do this, and you got to do that, and you got to do. That's why chanting is so important. That's why temples. These temples are for us to be able to be reminded of Prabhupada's presence. But actually, he's very able to reach us. And yeah, it's been a big shock to all of Prabhupada's disciples. I'm sure you know. And your kirtans are beautiful. I can tell when somebody does kirtan, I have antennas. And there's real bhakti. Yesterday you led the kirtan. I was like, who is that leading that kirtan? My heart was just like, you know that warm feeling of your heart chakra? She didn't know. Your heart chakra is opening and pulsating whenever you're chanting good rounds or you're in a kirtan where someone's leading the kirtan and you're really feeling that bhakti is coming through. And I wanted to tell you I really, really appreciate it. You should lead kirtan more often. It was very nice. But all of us gray-haired Prabhupada disciples, we're all in the same boat. We're trying to do whatever he gave us to do. And that's why I'm here. I'm trying to share this because it's a very valuable gift that he's given us. And I think it's important not to take it for granted. I mean, one time there was this devotee who came from Russia. And this is years before Russia was opened up, before people could chant. And this devotee was in Los Angeles. And I was always interested in the Russian, because Prabhupada was always listening to the Russian. He was always thinking of Russia, always. He would sit and look at his globe and he would study. I have pictures of him turning his globe in his New York apartment, you know, where he had an atlas, you know what I'm talking about, you turn the globe. He would sit and study the globe. And sometimes he would say, Brahmananda, you shall go to Russia. Gorsundar, you shall go to Japan. Rai Rama, you shall go to South America, wherever. I mean, he did this, and we were a handful of teenagers with barely enough money to pay the rent. Be real. I mean, we didn't know what he was, but he had big plans. It was not something he just later decided. And so, you know, we're doing what we can do with what little bit of time that we have left. But Srila Prabhupada was well aware of what he was doing. His plan was a worldwide movement. And just before he left this world, he was actually planning to take the movement in a new direction. Because there had been so many fall downs from the Brahmin and sannyasi and all this, he was not just interested in a hierarchical society, he wanted to help the whole society, the common man, all the people. And so he was planning the Varnashram, which is to let people work according to their nature. Maybe their nature is not that of a Brahmin, maybe their nature is to scrub bathrooms. Maybe their nature is to do something, drive oxen or grow food or do artists, whatever their nature may be, but to offer everything to Krishna. He was planning to move the direction in a varnashram system, and that will still take place, maybe not in our lifetime so much, but that is definitely the future that he wanted for ISKCON society and for the world, not just for this society, but for the world at large. And I'm sure that whenever the society breaks down, and often he said this oil-based society is not going to last. It's just not going to last. I mean, I really hope it lasts for as long as I'm here, because I'm very attached to my blender and my... I don't think I can make it without electricity, frankly. But there are people, you know, the Amish have been doing it for 300 years. The Amish don't use electricity. They do, they're all in the, you know, and they live a very simple life, and they're actually very healthy and beautiful and so forth. Unfortunately, they eat meat. But that time may come in the future. And Prabhupada basically kept telling us, be prepared, get land, get farms, get vegetables growing, get cows, be ready. This society could collapse at any time. Whether it's going to collapse due to the paper money, he used to make fun of the paper money all the time. He would always call this paper money, it will turn into toilet paper. You know, it's like he would make fun of the paper money. He was quite sarcastic about some of the things in our society. One time he went to the doctor in L.A., and the doctor took a blood test, and Prabhupada said, across the street, they pay me to pay, take my blood, and you want me to pay you. You know, he was quite critical of Western society, and predicted much of what's going on today. He talked about regularly, 40 years ago, at a time when nobody talked about the money collapsing 40 years ago. Those were the heydays. Nobody talked about these things. Or maybe there was a few handful of radicals someplace. But generally speaking, Prabhupada was so ahead of his time and above all of the platforms that we know. He could see things from a very high platform. Anyway, I think that's about it. If there's no more questions, everyone's tired and it's cold outside.
Just one more question.
Oh, another question?
Okay. I had a question. Have you written a book?
Well, I'm working on a book of my memoirs. Some of it's done, but I am working on memoirs. I think that it's really important. It's something I need to do, because I think that this is one way, and this is an important point. This is one way that the next generations can actually have an experience of being around Srila Prabhupada. Because just like when we come here and we talk about him, everybody has a smile on their face, they feel happy, they feel light, and that's because when you talk about him, he's present. When somebody talks about me, I ain't present. When somebody talks about him, he's present, because he's a transcendental personality that is far beyond anything we know. So, if you read the books written by, I understand Jamuna's book is out. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm really looking forward to, I understand they're going to be selling that this weekend. I ordered one already, but I ordered for it to be sent to Hawaii, and I'm here. So I'll get another one. And Chutananda's book is one of the best ones I've read. Gurudas's book is very, very nice. Mukunda's written a nice book. All of these are really helpful so far as getting to know Srila Prabhupada. Shamsundar is working on his. I talked with him recently, and he said it's coming along really well. The Lilamrita is a very good, well-researched, chronological, you know, it really, especially the early years, it has a lot of information so far as the early years. But so far as the traveling with Prabhupada and so forth, it's written from a person who was, it's like second, you know what I mean? It's not like a person who was right there. It's written mostly from accounts. So it has its value in the sense that it's well-researched, but when you read some of these direct accounts, like of Brahmananda's book is out, I've heard. Of course, Achyutananda's. I think it's good because all of these devotees, we're all going to be gone in a very short time, in a few years, and it gives... It's those people who were really close to Srila Prabhupada, who were with him on a day-to-day basis and were able to sense and to express what it was like to be around him. So I think it's real important to read those books. And that will give the association for the generations that come. Yeah, I'm working on it. In between a lot of other things. It takes a lot of... it's almost like you have to go into a trance to remember everything and to just go back in time. And to do that, you can't really be doing other things. And my life has not been allowing that in the last few years. I've been taking care of my mother. But part of it is already done. I have a whole first section that's done. Well, it's 8:30. I guess it's time to almost 8:30. Thank you very much for coming and braving this cold and coming. It's nice to have people to ask the questions because otherwise I can't think of what to say.
I wanted to announce that next week's Q&A will be on Wednesday night because Thursday's Thanksgiving, so... And it'll be the last talk in the series next Wednesday, so please come.
Thank you for